Every human in Antarctica has one focus: science. The goals of every other species of animal living near the end of the world are much more mysterious to us, and they tend to be the subject of our scientific inquiry. That's been the long-term goal of our next guest, to better understand how marine mammals like whales live their lives near the South Pole. He's been on more than 25 research trips to Antarctica, and his findings will find a much wider audience through the National Geographic Channel this month and next. Dr. Ari Friedlander is Associate Professor at Oregon State University's Marine Mammal Institute, and he joins us now. Hi, Ari.
Hey there.
Hi. So seeing a whale, I've had this unique privilege. It's a really humbling experience, but it tends to end at the water's surface for most of us. Not for you. How do you approach learning more about the underwater lives of marine mammals?
Well, that's a great question, and that's exactly the motivation for our research, is because these animals spend about 95% of their time underwater, and that's where they do most of their activities. And so we've worked with engineers and other researchers to develop some tag technology that's similar to things like GoPro cameras and smartphones to literally show us what these whales are doing underwater and how they make a living.
Really? I mean, when you think of a tag, I think of kind of an old rusty, like, beacon thing that, maybe not rusty, but it doesn't seem like the most sophisticated technology in some ways. How has it changed over the years from maybe what we think of when we think of just a radio collar on an animal, a terrestrial animal, or on a marine mammal?
You know, I tell people that these tags are very similar to things like your smartphone or the Fitbit that you might be wearing that measures your movements. And over time, as these sensors have become smaller and smaller, we've got different materials to help things stick to animals, and we've got ways to machine different kind of packages. We've produced a pretty small and efficient little thing that it almost looks like a little remora, something that would stick on the back of a whale, and we're able to keep these tags on for a good long time and sample things at hundreds of times per second.
Wow. So I'm going to be asking a lot of logistical questions, I think, throughout the course of this interview. First of all, could you just walk us through the tagging of a whale? And, you know, what kind of whale are you tracking down when you go to Antarctica? And then just the nuts and bolts, how do you get close to them and get one of these things on their backs?
Yeah, you know, I will say first off, it's the whales let us do it to them if they're willing. In the Antarctic, humpback whales and minke whales are the two species that are most commonly found in the nearshore waters where we work. The humpback whales that we work with are the same species as the ones that you would see off of Cape Cod or off of California or the Pacific Northwest. And they're about 45 feet long. They weigh 30 or 40 tons. And fortunately, they're pretty social animals. They are really good at feeding, and oftentimes, after a good feed, they're going to rest at the surface. And the goal for us when we try and deploy a tag is to not disturb the animals or to have them respond to us. So we approach very slowly in a small inflatable boat. We have about a 25-foot carbon fiber pole, and the tag sits at the end of that in a little housing. And the tag has silicone suction cups that just stick onto the skin of the whale. And so we approach the animal from an angle. We never want to go over the flukes, because if the animal does respond or react to us, those flukes could potentially be dangerous and knock us out of our boat or flip the boat over. So we approach from an angle at a very slow speed, and then hopefully the whales will let us get close enough that we can just slap this tag on their back, and then the whale is off and going and collecting data for us.
Wow, so silicon suction cups, you're not actually piercing the skin of the animal?
Not for these tags. The design of this tag is to collect data for about 24 to 48 hours. And to do that, we have suction cups that can stick on the animal for that long.
Oh, I see. And then
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then if we were interested in studying their movement over longer periods of time, like weeks or months, then we would put a tag on the animal that would probably anchor into their skin. But for this short-term work, suction cups are perfect.
So what can you learn about a humpback whale in 24 to 48 hours from this this little tracker that suction cups onto its back?
You know, we can learn things at a variety of scales. So we can learn things like how fast the animal swims, how deep it swims, how many times it feeds, what the orientation of the body is when it feeds. And from video cameras, we can see actually what the animals are feeding on. We can see how they navigate through, especially in the Antarctic, areas where there's sea ice cover, how they interact with other animals, and basically just get a glimpse into the lifestyle of these animals. And from an energetic standpoint, we can determine how much energy it costs these animals to feed and how they're gaining that based on the density or the amount of prey that they're encountering.
And so what are some of the things that you can't learn from these short-term sensors? Questions that you, as someone who's devoted so much life and love to studying whales, that you want to know and that you just can't quite get past the surface on?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. And what we try to do is we try to design our experimental work around the capacity of the tools that we have to answer questions. And so, you know, we 15 or 20 years ago, we didn't even have the technology to measure the motion of these animals underwater. And so as sensors have developed, we're taking advantage of different technologies that are available to us. And we're almost coming up with new questions every day or every week. And so we're trying to incorporate sensors into these tags that allow us to collect data for longer periods of time in this really high resolution. In the Antarctic, these whales are down there for 3 or 4 months at a time, feeding and gaining energy for this long migration that they take to the tropics to breed and then come back. And while we can tell you what an animal does in one day of its life, if we could tell you that over 2 or 3 months, we could learn about when the animals are putting on weight, how critical different areas are to these animals, and that'll help us understand how the threats in that system might affect the animals.
If you're just joining us, our guest is scientist and ecologist Ari Friedlander. He's an associate professor at Oregon State University's Marine Mammal Institute, and his long-term research on Antarctica will be on television, the National Geographic Channel's doing a multi-part series this month and next. You can join our discussion about researching whales and how all of that fits into a greater picture of the polar ecosystem. 800-838-3760 is our phone number, or jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Ari Friedlander, you were talking about the humpback species that you're studying near the South Pole. Are these the same species or perhaps even some of the same whales that we see swimming up the Pacific coast here in Oregon and California?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is the same species of whale that you would see in California or Oregon, but they're different populations that are isolated geographically.
Uh-huh.
So the whales that we work with in the Antarctic Peninsula, they migrate and breed in waters off the west coast of Colombia or Panama, even up to Costa Rica. The animals that we see on the west coast of the United States, they actually go down and breed in the same areas, but the timing of when they breed is offset. So the two populations don't really overlap in time, but they do spatially in some of their breeding grounds.
I see. And in terms of another population that's overlapping in Antarctica, and maybe we wouldn't normally think of it, is the humans that are there. I want to talk more about the logistics of how does a guy get to Antarctica, for one thing.
It's a great question. And fortunately, it's gotten a lot easier since, 100 years ago when folks like Shackleton and Douglas Mawson were trying to get down there. Essentially, what we do these days is to work in the Antarctic Peninsula, you fly down to the very southern tip of South America. Most of our trips leave from either the southernmost tip of Chile or Argentina, and then you take a boat for about 4 days to get across the Drake Passage, and eventually you wind up down in the Antarctic. And it's a long journey to get there, but, you know, to be honest, it feels like it should be. It's such a remote and such a different place that it takes a little time to kind of prepare yourself mentally from leaving the comforts of home and of civilization to getting to this really remote place.
How much time have you spent there?
I've been down, I think, about 25 times since 1997 or 1998. And usually we spend about 2 or 3 months down there. Sometimes we might make multiple trips in a year. If we're trying to understand how things work in different seasons, we might go a couple times during the year, but you know, generally 2 or 3 months at a time. And I guess if you multiply that by 25 times, it's been a few years of my life down there.
Have you been in the wintertime? Is that?
I have. Most of my dissertation research, was trying to understand the winter dynamics around the Antarctic Peninsula and how the ecosystem survives or how it functions in a very different time of year.
How does your human ecosystem function during that time of year? Tell us about the temperature and the sort of survival side of things.
I tell folks that working around the Antarctic Peninsula, it's kind of like going skiing. You know, if it's a sunny day and there's not a lot of wind, it can be comfortable. But as soon as the wind picks up or as soon as there's cloud cover, it can get aggressively cold. And if you're not prepared for that, you can be in a tough situation. And there are days where it's simply too cold for us to go outside and to be able to work. But you do what you can to prepare yourself and kind of tough it out as much as you can.
So is there a typical day for you when you're down there? You're part of a team on the peninsula that's looking to tag the whales and track their movements. That sounds very physical. We learned about, getting out there and trying to get these little tracking devices on the back, the physical back of a whale. So obviously you need to get outside. Maybe not a typical day, but can you walk us through that day? What time do you have to get up in the morning, for one thing, to get everything done before the sun sets on you?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I tell some of my friends that January is the longest day of the year for me. And I mean that because in the Antarctic, in the high summer, the sun doesn't set. And you've got 24 hours of daylight. And so what we try and do is work around the patterns and the behaviors and the rhythms of the animals. We know, for instance, that the animals will be really heavily feeding sort of during the dawn and dusk hours, and that during the day they might be resting a little more. And if our goal is to try and put out a tag on an animal, we might try and put ourselves in a location sort of late morning, and then when the animals are resting or not feeding, which makes it a little harder for us to get close to them, we'll wait till the animals are behaving in a way that allows us the best opportunity to get close to them. Oftentimes, though, it takes several hours to find them. Then you've got to get in a small boat and approach them, and certainly not every animal is as excited to volunteer for our project as others. So it can take some time just to locate an animal that's a good candidate for our work. And you end up spending, 8 or 10 hours at a time out on the water. And at some point, we simply have to come back in to warm up a little bit to get some food, and then we'll go back out. And, we recognize that the opportunities we have to work down there are so limited that we're willing to push ourselves a little bit in terms of being a little tired or a little cold, or a little frustrated to be able to get the work done, because it's not the kind of place you can just kind of get in your car and drive to.
Certainly not. And you mentioned that the winter time is an important piece of your research, understanding what's going on in the winter. Do you go out on a boat in the winter, or is it frozen over?
Yeah, we do the same things in the wintertime. Certainly, the boats that we work on, some of them have the capacity to break ice and to get deep inside the ice, while others can kind of just push it around. And so depending on the platform that we're on, that will dictate the environment around us. But in the wintertime, we just have a very short window to work in, where you might only have 3 or 4 hours of daylight. And so you have to be extremely efficient. And what we try and do is put out our instruments in that period of time and then kind of retreat to our big boat, where we can be doing things like measuring the environment, the amount of sea ice, the amount of food that's in the water column, and track the animals from a larger platform that doesn't require us to be in a small boat.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Ari Friedlander. He's a scientist, an ecologist, and associate professor at Oregon State University's Marine Mammal Institute, and a longtime researcher explorer of Antarctica and the marine mammals that live on the southern poles, our southern pole of our world. You can join our discussion 800-838-3760 or contact us by email jx@jeffnet.org. Dr. Friedlander, you mentioned that when you put tracking devices on a whale, not all of them are as keen to cooperate as others, and that the whales you're able to track with especially these short-term suction cup sensors, they let you do it. Can you tell us more about what that looks like behaviorally?
Yeah, one of the things about whales is you don't get big by not being good at what you do. And these animals are really efficient at foraging. They have these huge mouths that expand when they open them. And a humpback whale can get just about 100% of its body weight in water in its mouth at one time, which means you have the opportunity to take in a huge amount of food at one time as well. And because of that, it costs a lot of energy. And after you've fed for a while, we're all kind of accustomed to doing this. And especially on a time like Thanksgiving, you kind of sit on the couch and you you take a bit of a rest. And humpback whales in the Antarctic sort of do the same thing. They'll feed very intensively for 8 or 10 or 12 hours. And then after that, they'll basically sit at the surface and relax. And sometimes they'll be social with other animals. Sometimes they're almost unconscious. They're conscious in the sense that they aren't asleep, but they're basically just floating there. And that's the opportunity that we have to really get up close to them and put these tags on.
Let's talk about how your research fits in with I think there's 5 other teams of scientists who are highlighted in this upcoming National Geographic Channel series about Antarctica. And they're doing quite different things. We've got a team looking at the inner workings of Mount Erebus, another group who's drilling into the ice sheet, something, you know, an ice sheet the size of France. And it seems like you've got a lot of thinkers asking very different questions that are related to one another through a single ecosystem. How does your work fit in to the bigger picture, and how do these other projects inform your work?
That's a great question, and it's something that I think we all probably think about almost unconsciously. You know, I think about whales and these top predators as in an ecosystem. I think about the presence of whales or the abundance of whales as being kind of the emergent properties of this ecosystem and all of the things that have to take place in the right way, in the right time, in the right amounts to promote krill, to promote phytoplankton, to promote all of these things that make this a really super productive environment for life to exist. And whales being at the top of the food chain are sort of the end result of all of these processes. So for me, a whale represents how an ice sheet moves, you know, how the seismology of a volcano and how those things contribute to the oceanography or the processes in the ocean that then promote growth from phytoplankton and nutrients and sunlight that then allow krill to be successful at foraging, but then allow the whales to be there. And so understanding all of the components from the atmosphere to the ice sheets gives us a better understanding of what it is about this ecosystem that makes it habitable for all of these animals.
And you mentioned you've been going to Antarctica since 1997. Can you see the chaotic effects of climate change on this ocean and on these animals that you've studied?
Absolutely. You know, working in the Antarctic Peninsula, that's a region that's warming more rapidly than almost any other part of the world. And in the time that I've been down there, and I think it's important to think about things in as long a time series as you can, because there's a lot of variability from year to year. You know, one year might have a lot of sea ice, the next year might have very little. And if you just took those two data points, you wouldn't really be able to generate a trend. But over time, you get sort of a visceral kind of feeling for the environment. And I can definitely tell you there's glaciers that we're mapping that are retreating very quickly. There's places that are now exposed that haven't been in the past. There are species that are now more abundant in the Antarctic areas that we work than they were 15 or 20 years ago. And the species that have evolved to live in this very icy and cold environment are being pushed farther south where it's still cold enough and where the habitat is still functional for them. So we definitely see it both in terms of things like sea ice and the amount of sea ice cover, but also in the types and numbers of animals that are there.
And is there a consensus among your colleagues, other scientists deployed to Antarctica, that climate change poses a grave threat to the ecosystems there and beyond?
I would say that there's no question in my mind and in the colleagues that I work with that the rate of change that we see in the peninsula is something that you know, many of us believe that the animals that are evolved and have adapted for that ecosystem simply can't tolerate the changes as rapidly as they're occurring. And because of that, their populations will decrease either by them moving to a different area or them simply not being able to survive.
And Dr. Friedlander, we think of Antarctica as so remote. I mean, you talked about a four-day boat ride once you make it to Chile or South America, just to get close, talking about almost a week of traveling. Why does the ecosystem health of the South Pole matter to the rest of the world?
That's a really good question. And I think you can answer that in a number of ways. And I'll tell you sort of from my personal perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I believe that nature and wilderness has this heuristic value of being there for its own sake, and that we need wilderness to make us whole. We need these places that aren't within reach of people. And there's a sense of nature and wonder that you get from being in places that are wild and natural that you can't replicate. The other reason that it's important is because as harsh and as different and as, you know, tough an environment as the Antarctic is, we're affecting it with our behavior on this planet. And if the most, you know, extreme environments on this planet are being affected by what we do, we're really having an impact. And to me, working with folks like National Geographic gives us the opportunity to not only do our research, but to share those ideas and those concepts and those feelings with people that otherwise might not have the opportunity to be part of that. And while you can't really experience Antarctica without being there, I think what this series does is it shows it in a very human light, and in some cinematography, some ways that it's shot in very compelling ways that give you as good a feeling about the place as you can without actually having gone there.
Well, we are very lucky to get a glimpse into Antarctica without actually going there. As you mentioned, it sounds a bit uncomfortable. What's your number one thing that you pack to have some creature comfort when you're studying in Antarctica?
You know, I bring a lot of dried fruit. There's not a lot of fruit stands down there or good grocery stores, so you try and pack a couple of treats to keep you healthy.
All right, BYO fruit to Antarctica. We've been talking with Dr. Ari Friedlander. He's a scientist and ecologist with OSU's Marine Mammal Institute. Thank you, Dr. Friedlander.
My pleasure. Thank you guys for having me.
All right, if you want to learn more, the National Geographic Channel is premiering season one of the first ever global long-form documentary series filmed in Antarctica. It's called Continent 7, and you can check it out. First episode is actually tonight, 7 p.m. Pacific time, if you get the National Geographic Channel.